Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director here, and it's my pleasure tonight to welcome you to the In Conversation event with Gideon Rackman, the Chief Foreign Affairs Columnist for the Financial Times, the Pinken. There are probably half a dozen people in the world whose columns are a must read every week for someone who's interested in international relations, and that list would include Fareed Zakaria, Tom Friedman, who I may come to later, Gideon, Brett Stevens, David Ignatius, Anne Applebaum, and I would put put Gideon Rackman in that very elite company. What he says matters. What he says is read in capitals around the world. It's scrutinised. And so it's really a wonderful opportunity, I think, for everyone in the room to be able to ask him what he thinks about the world. Gideon has had a distinguished career with the BBC, The Economist, and for the last decade or more, the FT. The world had a big 2016, so did Gideon. He won the Orwell Prize for Journalism, was named Commentator of the Year by the European Press Prize, and published his latest excellent book, Easternization, War and Peace in the Asian Century. He writes widely and wittily. He writes with great humanity and curiosity and wisdom. And I always learn something from an interaction with Gideon, whether it's seeing him or reading him. I feel, Gideon, we are like-minded, and tonight I notice we are like-shirted as well. He has another great quality, of course, and that is the name Gideon. And what I notice is that people named Gideon do extremely well in international relations, and I feel that I've overcome a barrier by becoming director of the Institute without being called Gideon.
Oh, Gideon Rose.
For example, Gideon Rackman is the Chief Foreign Affairs Columnist at the FT. Gideon Rose is the editor, the whip-smart editor at Foreign Affairs in New York. And, of course, Gideon Oliver Osborne, also known as George, was the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK. And perhaps George Osborne would now be Prime Minister if he had just stuck with Gideon. I also think I'm right that Gideon Osborne applied for a job at The Economist, and he was interviewed by you, and you turned him down. So I'm assuming there was only room for one Gideon at The Economist.
Well, the question of the name change was hovering over our interview, actually. Why is it good enough for me? You know, what's your problem?
Gideon is in Australia for many reasons. One of them is that both of us will participate in the UK Australia Asia dialogue over the next couple of years. This is an initiative of then Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs William Hague and Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, where we get together and talk about Asia. He's here for other things too. He's been to Canberra and spoken to officials and academics, but he's also very kindly agreed to squeeze in a public event. So thank you, Gideon, and ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gideon Rackman. I'm going to have a conversation with Gideon for 20 minutes or half an hour, then I'm going to go to the audience and give everybody an opportunity to ask a question. So please start thinking now. There's always a rush of questions at the end, but if you get in early, if you get your hand up early, I'll try to get to you. Gideon, let me start with your own country, Britain, and let me ask, what on earth is happening there? The government appears to be on its knees. The Secretary of State for Defence has resigned. The Secretary for International Development has resigned. The Foreign Secretary is in hot water. The opposition is led by a man with crushes on various revolutionary figures. The Daily Mail is publishing photos of judges calling them enemies of the people. The Daily Telegraph is publishing photos of MPs calling them Brexit mutineers. Many of us read that very sharp column by Stephen Erlanger, the bureau chief in the New York Times, as he left, his farewell column, which I noted generated a sharp response from some of the tabloids. So what is happening? What has caused all this? And how are you going to get out of this rut?
Well, it's actually all a massive smokescreen we're throwing up to disguise our plan for world domination. It is a bit of a mess, as you point out. I think a lot of it does circle around Brexit. I mean, some of the governmental stuff, you know, the serial resignations and so on, you have phases of this. We had a bit of it in the 1990s when, you know, I think you're sort of familiar with it in Australia. Governments can go into tailspins.
We've heard of that, yeah.
But there is I think it, even the stuff that wasn't directly related to Brexit reflected a kind of a nervous breakdown is too strong, but it's something close to that, a sense that we're in a mess that we can't quite figure our way out of. Basically, what's happened is that the hopes of the Brexiters, that the process of leaving the European Union would be relatively straightforward and would lead to a better future, which was obviously all the pitch, are coming unstuck. But it's very, very difficult to reverse course. In fact, I don't think it's going to happen. And so we're now in this process of unpleasant realization of what it's going to mean, which is not to say that there is a universal assessment where everybody can see it's going badly. On the contrary, the country remains very, very divided, with the leavers still committed to the process. But I think even they are beginning to see that some of the stuff that they thought would never happen is happening, such as there's going to be a summit in about a week's time when I think it's going to be pretty clear that the Brits will commit to paying the EU 40 billion euros in, I was going to say reparations, not quite, but as part of the sort of leaving bill for the EU, that we will even then struggle to get trade negotiations going, that we are asking for a transition deal to basically bridge the period from when Britain formally leaves the EU in March 2019 to the period where we actually get a free trade deal. That is necessary because the trade deal was not as simple as the Brexiters said it would be. But even getting the transition deal, A, is a big ask, and B, involves quite humbling concessions from Britain, because we will have to continue to accept EU law for another 2-3 years without actually having any votes. So far from taking back control, we lose it. It's pretty bad. And meantime, the economic damage is beginning to make itself felt. I mean, I think that in the immediate aftermath, the leavers felt rather triumphant because there had been predictions that there would be a massive stock market crash. None of that didn't happen. And so there was this sort of sense that, oh, well, that was all project fear. In fact, it's going to be fine. But the costs are beginning to come through now. So we've had a 30% drop in the currency. Britain is now the slowest growing economy in the G7, having been the fastest growing pre-Brexit. And the predictions of economic growth ahead are nothing above 2% for 5 years, which again is unprecedented. So it's looking bad, but there isn't an ability to say, okay, let's rethink. That's not where we are now.
What about Boris Johnson? Mm. Boris gave the Lowy lecture this year, gave a very amusing and almost persuasive argument for what I regarded as a very poor decision. Mm. I think he struck most of the people in the room as a very attractive character, but I'm also aware that in the last few months, things have not gone swimmingly for Mr. Johnson. What would you say about his stewardship of British foreign policy, and what are his chances of moving into number 10?
I think pretty disastrous. And I say that as somebody who, I know him a bit, I like him in some ways. I think he is an able person, and he's a witty writer and so on. And so I was prepared to hope and believe that he was capable of defying his critics and making a success of the Foreign Office. But that doesn't seem to be how it's working out. I mean, I think it's interesting that he came over so well here. I think he has a kind of a sense of humor that works in the Anglosphere, in Australia, maybe a bit in America. But the Germans don't seem to find him funny for some reason. And I think that in Europe, he bears the stigma of being the public face of Brexit, which they regard as a mix between a massive insult and, gross act of irresponsibility, etc. So he starts badly, and then his style, as I say, doesn't go over. But I think also he's made a series of what have been regarded as gaffes. It's not really working. And I think that his weaknesses are also being exposed by his period as Foreign Secretary, which is he's very good at the big pictures. You say in an hour he can kind of persuade you that, wow, that sounds great. You know, he's got a very original kind of phrase. He's not stupid, but he doesn't really engage with detail. And so he's basically saying, it'll be fine. And then as we emerge, particularly, it must be a very frustrating guy to work with if you're the person who has to turn this big vision into detail, and you come and say, Foreign Secretary, there are these like 28 treaties we're leaving now, and what, how are we going to replace them? And that's not really, that's too detailed for him. And so that, I think, is where he's falling apart, because this whole question of, it goes from being a big vision to an enormous granular headache of unraveling legal relationships that have been put together over 50 years and more. It's a huge task, and I don't think it's one that he's really up to. And also, I think he's got a big political problem, because he was committed to this idea. This is the idea that has to, on which his reputation is going to be made or not. And if, as, you know, I was a Remainer, but if I'm right that it's not going to work, that's a pretty big problem. Now, if May is forced out, and there are various scenarios where she is forced out, because one of them would be that the Tory party says, hang on, we're just not prepared to hand over this 40 billion euros except continued ECJ rule, and there's a revolt from the right, and she falls, or the revolt could come from the Remainers for other reasons. Then there could be another Tory party election. But I think at this point, Boris probably wouldn't be favourite. But it's because of all this, the stuff that's worked out over the last year. But it's a sign of the desperation of British politics that Jacob Rees-Mogg, have you come across Jacob Rees-Mogg? He makes Boris Johnson look like kind of, somebody contemporary. He's sort of out Bertie Wooster's Boris. He's now one of the favourites. It's just incredible.
Another British figure to whom many of these problems may well fall is Mr. Corbyn. Mm. What are the chances of Mr. Corbyn moving into Downing Street, and what kind of a global Britain would it be under his leadership?
Well, I mean, that is my sort of nightmare scenario for Britain, is that we have Brexit followed by Jeremy Corbyn. We're just about to finish the place off. But I think it's quite likely, actually, because I think that if you look at the scenario, let's say Brexit does go badly, which I think it will, and it also causes continuing splits within the Tory party and the party at war with itself. Parties like that, and they've been in power a long time. You know, nothing in that suggests they're going to win re-election. And if they don't win re-election, well, who's going to replace them? The Labour Party. Certainly not the Liberal Democrats. The Labour Party are led by Corbyn. So that means Corbyn in power, possibly in coalition with the Scots Nats or the Lib Dems, and that is one of the Remainers' kind of dream scenarios, that somehow that then leads to a second referendum. Probably be too late, though, because we'll be out by then. And then how does Corbyn respond? Well, look, if it's the Jeremy Corbyn of before he became leader of the Labour Party, then we're in for, the British kind of Che Guevara politics, because this is a guy who's actually majored on foreign policy, really, in the opposition, but who's causes were Venezuela, the Palestinians to some extent, basically every anti-American third world cause was his. And I think that was the connecting kind of theme in his thought, was deep suspicion of the US. He was also very anti-nuclear, wants to get rid of the Trident thing, anti-EU incidentally, because it was too capitalist for him. So he's really the hard left in his previous guise. And the person he appointed as his chief spokesman, if you want to get a flavour of his foreign policy thinking, was Seamus Milne, the Guardian columnist, who is an extremely posh Stalinist, and whose kind of his writings would give you a sense of where he was from. For example, pretty pro-Milosevic over the Yugoslav wars and so on. However, I think it's actually unlikely that Corbyn would bring that agenda straight into Downing Street, because I think we've already seen that he's been able to be reasonably pragmatic, quite intelligent in the way he's handled Labour. I think his instincts probably are still there, but he will have a huge task when he comes in. He will want to avoid scaring the markets too much, because that would launch him immediately into a crisis if the pound halved in value, or the markets or banks crashed. So I think it would be Project Reassurance for a while. And also, I think his priorities will probably be domestic, to do with renationalizing various bits of the economy and so on. So I think he might do a few gestures of on foreign policy, but I don't think, for example, that he would immediately renounce British nuclear weapons. What you might do, though, however, is have a new defense review in which nuclear weapons would be on the table for the first time, seriously. And I think that, you know, personally, I'm not that shocked by that. I think that would be an appropriate debate to have, given the defense cuts that we're having and the sheer cost of maintaining the nuclear deterrent. I don't know where we would come out on it or what would be the right choice, but I don't find it inherently shocking that there would be a serious discussion of that. I think that, in a funny way, you know, that Britain, because of Trump, mightn't be so unhappy with taking a slightly more distant view of the United States. So in that sense, Corbynism wouldn't be that shocking. But he's not somebody whose judgment I trust, put it that way. And I think that even with Trump, a policy of equidistance between Russia and the US, which I think is where he would be emotionally, or maybe even a little bit closer to Russia, is not really one that's sustainable for Britain in the long run.
What about the countries between Britain and Russia? A few months ago, I think a lot of us were cheered by developments in Europe. You had an adult in charge in Berlin, and in Paris you had this shiny new president. Now, in the interim, of course, now Chancellor Merkel is having great difficulties forming a new government, and some of the shine has come off Monsieur Macron. So, I mean, should we be optimistic or pessimistic about developments on the continent, do you think?
I think it's gone through an arc this year, so that if you started in January, there was a real feeling of panic in Europe because they'd just seen what had happened in Britain and the US. You had Le Pen looking like a really serious candidate for the French presidency, the Dutch elections coming up. And then in the first half of the year, populists lose in the Netherlands and Macron wins in France, and Merkel's situation post the refugee crisis seems to have stabilized. She's ahead in the polls, and everyone goes, phew. And the other thing is that Brexit starts going badly, and so this worry that it was going to set up a kind of avalanche of other countries leaving becomes clear that's not going to happen. The EU maintains its unity over Brexit, and even economic growth revives, and the Italian banks look less worrying, and everything's looking pretty rosy by the middle of the point of the year. I think now some of the shine's come off that. The economic bit's still true, the unity of Brexit is still true, but the German situation is a little bit worrying because Merkel's freedom of action is potentially inhibited by her difficulties forming a government. Macron's whole policies, his international and domestic policies are interlinked. It's sort of, I will do reforms in France, in return I'll get a more amenable Germany, which will press ahead with Eurozone reform of a sort that's amenable for France. Now, that's a bit more in question, given that we don't know what kind of German government comes out. Actually, if the SPD go back into grand coalition with Merkel, it might work out for Macron, because they're quite pro-Europe. Mm. So, but it's kind of in the balance. And meanwhile, there are other negative developments. I think more and more people are worried by what's happening in Poland and Hungary, and whether these countries are even really truly democratic anymore, whether there's an assault on the freedom of the press, institutions. What can the EU do about that? And if they don't do anything, what do we make of the idea of the European Union as a community of democracies and values and so on? What's happening in Spain is pretty remarkable. The Catalan attempted declaration of independence, the imprisonment of some of the Catalan politicians. The EU is basically just hoping that the Spanish will find a way of sorting it out. But if you look at the big picture, you could say that within the EU, and Britain's still in the EU, you've got maybe five or six biggish countries, France, Germany, Britain, Poland, Italy, Spain. And of those, in different ways, most of their politics is in crisis. I mean, Britain's got Brexit, Poland's democracy is under question, Spain is threatened with breaking down, Italy's economic situation is still pretty parlous, the banking crisis could return, and they have an election with a strong populist wing next year. France dodged a bullet in the presidential election, but and Germany is struggling to find a coalition government. So I wouldn't say it's all sunshine and roses.
Great. continuing further east, I mentioned Mr. Friedman earlier. I don't know if there's a columnist's emerita where you don't criticise or refer to each other's columns, but I do want to ask you about his latest column on Saudi Arabia, because it's been a long time since a column has attracted so much interest, and frankly... Oh, I haven't read
Okay. Ask me about it anyway, because I've seen the backwash.
Okay.
So summarise it.
All right, well... That's a very neat way of observing the emerita, isn't it? In that case, let me ask you, I mean, as you know,
so he was very pro-MBS.
Very pro-MBS. So let me put the question to you that way. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Sultan's plans to reform Saudi? Is this good news, or is it troubling that all these princes and zillionaires are being locked up in the hotel?
Yeah. The world's most luxurious prison. Well, I mean, I think MBS is by all, Mohammed bin Salman is by all accounts a pretty compelling figure. I haven't met him personally, but the last time I actually saw Tom Friedman, he and my editor were competing over who's had a more exotic and longer conversation with MBS, and was it 2 hours, and was it in a tent, or was it, you know, whatever. So he's quite good at seducing visiting Westerners. He says a lot of things that we want to hear, and some of them sound pretty positive. For example, talking about cracking down on Wahhabism, saying that, you know, this has disgraced Saudi Arabia in the eyes of the world, damaged Saudi Arabia, and that he's going to stop Saudi sponsorship of some of the more disturbing movement, Islamist movements around the world. If that can be taken at face value, that would be great news. And there are some signs that domestically he is taking them on. The decision to allow women to drive, the talk of liberalizing in other areas, entertainment and so on, the hope to create a kind of Saudi version of Dubai, you know, which has a more liberal flavor to it as a means of diversifying the economy. Other things in economics seem to make sense. The realization that they have to diversify, that they can't just, and really trying to make a proper effort to do that. But I think in other areas, you know, he sounds like he could be dangerously reckless, because although we want a reforming Saudi Arabia, we certainly don't want a Saudi Arabia that's either in turmoil domestically, because it's still the world's largest oil producer, or that is at war with its neighbors. And on those two counts, he's quite concerning. Who knows what's really happening with this power struggle that's going on, but clearly the elite is divided. And secondly, one thing in which he hasn't changed the traditional Saudi line, but if anything has intensified, is in hostility to Iran, and that's beginning to destabilize the Gulf itself, so that you have this Cold War with Qatar, which is now blockaded off by the other Gulf states, essentially proxy wars breaking out in Yemen, which is a kind of appalling human tragedy, which the Saudis are largely responsible for, and which the West is complicit in because we sold them all the weapons. And now a sense that maybe he's thinking of trying to take on the Iranians in Lebanon with the it's weird episode where the Prime Minister of Lebanon resigned while he was in Saudi Arabia. He had briefly to be almost taken hostage. But there seems to be a sense that maybe he wants to take on Hezbollah and so on. So if MBS's reforms lead to an even wider war in the Middle East and turmoil in Saudi Arabia, no, he's not good news.
What about Mr. Trump, who's famously formed a close relationship with MBS? Do you think Trumpism in the United States is a trend, or is it a blip?
That's really probably the biggest question facing us all, because the US is the bedrock of the system and so on, and I don't think we can know yet. But, you know, you go to America a lot, as I do, and I think that the American establishment is still in shock, and us having this debate itself. So one friend of mine, you probably know him from Brookings days, Jeremy Shapiro, wrote quite a funny piece where he said that Europeans are treating America like it's Britain under George III, where the kings, they've got a crazy king, but there's a sort of regency going on, and other people will run the place until the crazy king is sort of ushered off the stage, and then a sane king will be put in place, and it'll all be fine. And I put this theory to one of the kind of graybeards of American foreign policy, and I said, well, what do you think of this theory? And he said, well, that's what we all hope, but none of us can be sure. The reason being, you know, in terms of it being a blip, just briefly, what would one argue in on that side of the ledger? You would say American institutions still strong, the Mueller investigation goes forward, the press remains basically free, the courts still operate independently, and the policy people around Trump basically are not Trumpists. People like Bannon and so on are out, and the adults are still around, Mattis, etc. So that suggests that there's a kind of deeper forces. And also, it's not clear that there is ever going to be a politician quite like Trump again. So once he's gone, you'll probably get a more conventional Republican figure coming in. So those are the kind of more reassuring aspects. Plus, the economy is doing quite well. But set against that, I think you would say it's not clear that Trump won't get reelected at all. The same people who say he can't get reelected were the people who said he couldn't get elected in the first place. Secondly, to put it bluntly, he could start a war. He has a hair trigger temper. He's making all sorts of incredibly bellicose noises towards North Korea. One doesn't know how that'll work out. And that, obviously, particularly if it's with a nuclear state like North Korea, could change everything. And thirdly, even if Trump goes, he is thirdly, a couple of things. Even if he goes, America's already elected him, and in doing so has said something quite disturbing about the country. As a friend of mine, liberal friend of mine, put it, whatever happens will always be the country that elected Trump. And other countries will have to aim off a bit when they look at America, because they'll think, well, what else could they do, if they're capable of this? And even if he goes, he's identified a new political formula which people like Steve Bannon are working on, which is a sort of populism is what it's called, but it's got elements like protectionism, culture wars at home, a much more skeptical attitude to America's security commitments. And those themes, if politicians can see there's a formula out there that works, of course somebody else is going to pick it up. So I don't think they're going to disappear from America. So my sense is that he's not a blip, actually, that America has changed.
Let me ask you a final question, then I'm going to throw to the audience. What about Xi Jinping? There was a lot of awed reporting of the 19th Party Congress and about his strength and authority. Of course, the rise of China and the rise of Xi Jinping asks very hard questions of us here in Australia. Do you think we should be, are you more impressed by China's strengths and the advantages it brings to the field, or the persistent weaknesses? And are you more impressed by Xi's personal qualities and the extent to which he's confounded many of the observers and many of the predictions by consolidating power very quickly? Or are you more repulsed, if that's not too strong a word, by the increasingly illiberal character of Chinese society, the tightening of controls, the locking up of the human rights lawyers, and so on?
Both impressed and repulsed at the same time. I mean, I think that it is striking that, like a couple of years ago, certainly the people I was speaking to in Beijing, there was a lot of conspiratorial stuff about, he's antagonized so many people, he's arrested so many people, he's taken on senior generals and billionaires and so on. There's got to be a plot against him, people saying, oh, he doesn't even sleep in the same place every night. I have no idea if it was true, but that was the sort of idea, that he was actually creating a hornet's nest that could devour him if hornet's nests devour you. But now I think there's a sense that actually he's through that, and that his power has been consolidated. And if anything, he may be digging in for not just for another 5 years, but for even longer. So in that sense, he's been very effective. I do think that although probably there was a need for an anti-corruption drive, clearly it also has political uses in purging his enemies. And yeah, I think it is a bit disturbing what's going on in terms of this creation of cult of personality and also strengthening of party rule. And I was there just whenever, about a month ago when he gave his big speech and the party congress was on. And although nationalists were pretty exultant about, the strong China was showing to the world, the kind of liberals that I know were unhappy, skeptical. I mean, they haven't disappeared, but they are very cowed. And so that one guy, an academic I know, said that all the heads of department at his university had been told that they had to assemble and watch the speech, all 3.5 hours of it, together in a room. And when one of them wasn't there, he was contacted by the party's propaganda department and asked where he was, and then asked to send a photo of himself watching the speech so that they could, publicize. And they said, this stuff was unthinkable even 3 years ago. Things were easing up, and now they're very much not. Mm. It's going the other way. And that's, I think it's not particularly attractive. Mm. What was the first bit of the question? Was the are there going to be more kind of the weakness or strength thing? To put it briefly, I mean, I've always been slightly more of a sort of strength than weakness person, partly because of experience. When I was Asia editor of The Economist between 95 and 97, and I remember even then it was quite fashionable to say, well, they haven't settled down after Tiananmen and the banking system's about to crash and the state-owned enterprises up to here in debt and it's all going to be a house of cards. It wasn't, actually. Then in 2001, somebody wrote a book called China's Coming Crash, which I've still got on my shelf, which, we're still waiting. And it's true, obviously. I mean, even the Chinese will say this. The central bank governor has talked about the possibility of a Minsky moment of a crisis, financial crisis. So, and there have been shocks a couple of summers ago in the stock market and so on. So clearly there are instabilities in the system, and they may have a financial crisis at some point. But I think people who then seize upon that and say, aha, it's all over, we can relax, will obviously be wrong. China's now the largest or second largest economy in the world, depending on your unit of measurement. And I don't think that progress is going to be reversed. Mm.
I did have a chuckle at the picture of, I think it was Jiang Zemin, asleep during Xi Jinping's 3.5 hour speech, and someone said he's having his own China dream. let me go to the audience and give my colleagues here an opportunity to ask a question. This is the first gentleman I saw. If you could wait for a microphone, sir, and then if you could tell us your name and ask a brief question.
My name is Eran Weiner. Question to Gideon. Do you think that MBS pressure in the Middle East is not only encouraged by the United States, by Trump, but also supported by Israel, as we see that Israeli Chief of Staff and the Air Force Commander just returned from Saudi Arabia, and MBS forming, it seems that they're forming coalition with Abdullah of Jordan, Assisi in Egypt, and pushing towards the Shiite section of the Middle East. And as we sit here, I understand that Hezbollah is now pulled back, and the Iranian bases in southern Syria has been sort of the constructions have been reduced. So, if this is happening, obviously it's advantage for Israel, advantages for Trump, where he'll do the deal of the century that he's talking about, and maybe it'll be some sort of sensible relationship over there.
Maybe. I mean, I think that Trump was. Clearly gets on well with the Saudis. It's interesting. Also because they can lay out their autocrats, and he's more comfortable with autocrats. It's interesting. He hasn't come to London, I think partly because they're worried about demonstrations, but you're not going to have that problem in Riyadh or Beijing. But I think, beyond that, you're right. There is Trump, I think, in a way that Obama wouldn't have done, obviously, was willing to align himself with the Saudi view of Iran and the Israeli view of Iran, whereas I think Obama was trying to keep more of a balance. that could be good for Israel. I mean, clearly that is the view also of the Netanyahu government, and they've been drawing next to the Saudis, if you can keep it within bounds. But if it leads to a war with Hezbollah, which is possible, I mean, the Israelis have been worried about that for some time, and have looked at, you know, the missile build-up, etc., in southern Lebanon, then maybe it's not so good for Israel. But I mean, you know, certainly by the Israeli government's own estimate, I think there is certainly a concordance of view between the Israelis and the Saudis, no doubt about it. And I think that the Israelis also hope that by aligning themselves with the Sunni world against Iran, that then weakens their isolation within the Middle East. Although I remember talking to some Israeli, this was a few years ago, official about this, and I said, you know, does the fact that you share this view of Iran mean the Saudis don't hate you anymore? And he said, no, they just hate us a bit less. But, you know, I think they're rightly skeptical about how far the Arab world will go, the Sunni world will go to embrace them. But yeah, it's quite a kind of interesting alignment.
Yes, sir.
Hi. my name's Andrew Doherty, and I suppose it's relevant for the question that I'm a physicist at the University of Sydney, not any sort of foreign policy expert. So you said that the U.S. Establishment is in shock with respect to Trump. And I was wondering if you could sort of compare that with what's going on in the U.K. I'm sort of amazed traveling to the U.K. and the U.S. that, you know, at sort of conference, coffee breaks and dinners, you know, my friends and colleagues just can't talk about anything other than the political directions in the U.K. And they're sort of depressed about Brexit and basically every trend there. Whereas in the U.S., you sort of hear nothing unless you bring it up. And I would say that shock's somehow the right word. I was just wondering, you know, is it just the scientists who are running around like headless chickens in the U.K., or is there a more general problem?
The scientists may feel a particularly direct threat because of EU funding for university projects. So, you know, it's interesting whether Brexit or Trump is worse. It sounds like a sort of meaningless parlor game, but clearly they're related events. I, in a rather defensive way, thought Trump was worse because it seems to me that Brexit's like a horrible mistake, but it's not obviously appalling, like, sorry to any Trumpers out there, like voting for somebody who'd run a campaign like Trump's. On the other hand, Brexit has direct real-world effects to the economy and so on, which arguably Trump needn't have. As I say, the American economy is still going well. So it's a kind of slightly disturbing insight into the political culture of America, but it needn't be irreversible in its effects. Whereas I think Brexit, if we go through with it, probably does kind of lasting damage. But on the terms of elite shock, I mean, I think the one thing that does link Trump and Brexit is that if you look at the coalitions of voters, really the biggest cleavage in both countries was between people who'd gone to university and people who hadn't. The strongest predictor in Britain of whether you would vote, remain or leave was whether or not you'd been to university. And apparently that was the same in over Trump, whether or not you were a graduate or not a graduate. Was the strongest predictor whether you voted for that. So there is a, and to the extent that the non-graduates won, the kind of educated elite are suddenly thinking, oh, we kind of lost control here, and what do we do about it? As one of my colleagues put it, it's the first time in his life that he's felt a political change that directly seemed aimed at making his life worse. And maybe the elites have been in control for quite a while and have set the agenda and are now, I suppose, feeling that sense of powerlessness that a lot of the people who voted for Trump and Brexit had felt for many years and are now expressing.
Let me pull together a couple of these themes, if I can, and ask you to what extent is this a transition moment for the West? You've talked about the West a couple of times in the discussion, and there was a sense for a long time that Western countries ran things through the G7, we dominated the global economy. We're now at this moment where you have in United States, you have a clownish president who basically doesn't believe in Western, a number of important Western values. In Russia, you have a wily leader of an admittedly declining state, but nevertheless one who's willing and skillful at using all aspects of state power to undermine the West. And in Beijing, you have a very impressive leader of a rising power that really bulks very large indeed. And then you have a number of other events like Brexit and weird election results. How much of a moment is this? Are we exaggerating its importance because we're sort of in the middle of it, hearing the sirens outside and wondering what it all means? Or is this really a moment that people will be writing books on in 30 years' time and say, that was the moment when the West lost control?
Right. I don't know whether they'll be saying that, but I think in 200 years' time, if we're still around, you know, history undergraduates will be trying to explain how did Donald Trump get elected, what did it mean? You know, it's a big, big, extraordinary event in American political history. And, yeah, I'm inclined to see it as a sort of symptom of something going awry in the West. In fact, Trump's whole pitch was to do with decline. And unlike most American presidents, you know, Reagan said our best days lie ahead, Clinton was the boy from hope and all of that, they tended to campaign on optimism. And here was a candidate who won by saying, actually, it's all gone wrong, we're being laughed at overseas, we face carnage at home domestically. So he won by appealing to a widespread sense of decline. And I think that there was some reality to that. I mean, at least relative decline. So that you said the G7 used to run the show. Well, the G7 only came together in the late 70s, and when it did, it accurately reflected the seven largest economies in the world, and only one of them was non-Western, it was Japan. By the time of the financial crisis of 2008, it's clear the G7 is no longer enough. It's not the locus of economic power. So you have the G20 formed, which includes China, India, Indonesia, Australia. That was necessary. And again, if you look at measures of economic power, the basis, I guess, of strategic power, they've shifted so that by some measures, if you did by purchasing power, China became the world's largest economy in 2014. It's not yet in real exchange rates, but that'll probably happen. But in other ways, China is now the world's largest manufacturer. It's the world's largest exporter. There are more countries whose biggest trading partner is China than biggest trading partner is the United States. They include, obviously, Australia, but also Germany. And China is also now just not only the sort of massive manufacturer that we've got used to, an exporter, but also a huge market. It's the world's largest market for vehicles, world's largest market for smartphones. There's been a big economic shift in gravity, and that affects, I think, the West's sense of who we are, because the West dominated the world in one way or another for 500 years. Really, since the onset of the European colonial age. And that, I think, is we can feel that's coming to a close. And that's probably a sort of background thing in all these perturbations in our politics.
Let me go to Alex Oliver, and then I'll go to this gentleman here.
Thank you, Michael. Alex Oliver from the Lowy Institute. Gideon, thank you very much for that panoramic view. Can I ask you just to zoom back in on Britain again and post-Brexit Britain, if it's thrived on its economic and soft power in the sort of post-colonial, post-war world, what is going to happen to... Are you optimistic about its economic and cultural power, soft power?
Well, I have to be after Brexit. A bit, because I live there. And, I suppose I tend to, in my more optimistic moments, generally think that it's going to be really bad for about 3 or 4 years, but there will... We'll figure a way through, and then eventually it will be a prosperous, reasonably successful country. And that a lot of the things that make Britain successful will still be there. The legal infrastructure, education system, English language, size of the economy, whatever. Those things are not going to go away, and the British, I'm also now ancient enough to have seen cycles of decline, you know, had a very bad 1970s and then came back a bit. So I hope it'll be okay in the medium term, even if it's not great in the short term. The gloomier counter-argument to that, which I've just been sort of thinking through, is that that cycle of decline and revival in Britain, and I think often around the world, people tended to associate the revival part with Thatcherism, that you have this prime minister who comes in and does some very necessary reforms and the economy revives. You could argue that maybe the other thing that happened around the mid-70s was Britain joined the European Union. And was exposed to a much larger market that sharpened up the economy. It also enabled Britain to become the financial center of Europe, to attract in a lot of American investment into that because it became the basis for Europe. It enabled manufacturing industry to revive because the Japanese came in and set up a whole bunch of car plants which were aimed to export towards Europe. But we didn't think that was what was driving it. We thought it was something else. And we may find that if we leave the EU that actually we've just taken away something that was really important for the revival of Britain. We'll see. It's an interesting experiment.
Be careful with that counterfactual. You might find your photo on the front page of the Daily Mail or the Daily Telegraph with that kind of incorrect thought. Yes, sir.
Thanks very much. Sean Connor, first of all, like just one thing in relation to Trump. As it happened, I pulled out the other night a Washington Post analysis of who voted for Trump. And while it was true that the majority of people, that a greater number of college graduates voted Democrat, if you look at the income levels, you find that's not nearly as true. And in fact, a high proportion of Trump voters were earning $80,000 to $100,000 a year and above, and which causes one to reflect that in fact what the Republican Party is now doing in power in terms of tax and other areas is in fact responding to exactly the same electorate as Trump, albeit in a different way, and that it doesn't have as much to do with college education as it does actually with income, and it's not the people you might expect. But having just finished reading your most excellent book, Easternization, and it really is superb, can I ask that in the second edition, in relation to China, that there are a couple of elements of Chinese potential weakness that might bear further examination. The first is the obvious one, which is the aging of China, and to some degree that's dealt with. But the second one, which is I don't think you referred to, but which is not commonly referred to, is the collapse of Chinese education. Not at the top end, not in Shanghai and Beijing and the best areas, in the sort of figures we now see in terms of our comparisons, but in terms of the average education in villages and below, and the fact that anything up to 40% or so of the population of cities like Beijing and Shanghai can't in fact put their kids in school because they're not registered as residents, and that is really a huge Achilles heel as far as China's concerned.
Well, thank you on the book. That's very kind of you. On the education thing, I'll defer to you. I haven't really focused on that, and it does sound something that we should be thinking about. And on the demography, I agree, actually. Although I said I'm a sort of China bull, the one bit of the kind of bearish case that I've never been able to debunk in my own mind is the demographic issue. And we know the power of demographics from what's happened to Japan. It's also one of the problems in Europe. The dependency ratios are getting out of whack as populations age and shrink in some cases. And that is a significant drag on economies. So in the next 20 to 30 years, according to past patterns, it probably will slow up China, although, who knows, as we enter an age of automation and so on, maybe actually the economic effects won't be quite as potent as they've been in the past.
I'll take one more audience question if the person will promise to be quick. Yes, sir, if you can keep it concise.
Dallin Hamilton, and I'm a master's student studying foreign policy. Just a question about how we deal with China and the massive tectonic changes in the power. Obviously, with the meeting of the Quant around the ASEAN meeting, I was just heard a speech by the Senator Penny Wong where she was very much of the opinion that we should get the relationship with China right first and then move to our broader strategic interests in Asia. And it would seem that the Liberal Party is much more of the view that you go to Asia through the allies, the US allies. That was very much an argument in the Obama administration. I'd just like to hear your thoughts on where you fell on that question and what we should do as the West, perhaps a bit more bilaterally, Australia or the UK or America, in dealing with these massive changes. Thank you.
Gosh, well, I mean, it's you're right. It's the big question. I'm not sure what I'd do if I was Australia, to be honest. I mean, I think that the placing your bet on America now was a little tricky even during the Obama period, given the economic shifts that we were describing and the questions that were even evident during the Obama era about American staying power in Asia and America's willingness to really follow through on its security guarantees if it were ever really confronted by an aggressive China. And I think that with Trump in power, those questions are even more acute, not partly because of he has an isolationist strain and a protectionist strain, but also simply because of his sheer unpredictability and what that says about the unpredictability of the United States. I actually couldn't tell you how Trump would react in a South China Sea crisis or whatever. My guess is that he would be very reluctant to confront China, but you know, he has a hair-trigger temper. One doesn't really know how he would respond. But given that what you're looking for in an ally is somebody who's utterly predictable in the way that they would come through in a crisis, that doesn't look like Donald Trump to me. On the other hand, you know, in one sense, the view you attributed to Senator Wong about get the relationship with China right first makes very good sense, but it also doesn't answer, well, what does that actually mean in practice? If that means prioritizing the relationship with China, if that means accommodating, taking a more China-centric view of Asia, which is, I think, the Chinese would want, well, where does that, what does those demands mean? What kind of implications will they have for your freedom of action in the region, even for your domestic arrangements? Because I know you're beginning to have debates about, well, what's taught at universities and is it offensive to China's view of the world and given the numbers of Chinese students studying here? At what point is aligning yourself with China going to limit Australia's freedom of action, not just in terms geostrategic terms, but in terms of the kind of investments you approve and your own domestic arrangements? China isn't obviously a liberal power, and I think it's becoming more assertive and as it becomes more powerful. So there is a sort of values issue as well, which is a difficult one for Australia. So I think that my guess is that Australia will continue to hedge and, you know, try to keep the relationship going with both countries and avoid confronting either. And under the circumstances, although it may not be the most sort of intellectually satisfying answer, it probably is the practical response.
And if I can just ask one follow-up and the final question of the evening, what's the connection here between political strength at home and strong foreign policy abroad? Because my response to the white paper was that there was a lot of good stuff in there, but given the instability and churn we've had in Australia, I'm not sure I believe in the ability of the Australian government and Australian prime ministers and foreign ministers to really run a strong, complicated, nuanced foreign policy because they're so focused on internal issues. You mentioned when I was speaking to you earlier how internally focused Britain is at the moment because of Brexit. I mean, is this not one of the real challenges for the West that so many of our democracies are in turmoil and therefore their ability to present a united front but also to be outward facing, to be prepared to take risks, to spend treasure and blood in the international sphere is quite limited? And doesn't that present an opportunity to the kind of strong men we've talked about earlier?
That's always been the kind of alleged attraction of authoritarianism, is that they are able to, you know, they're not less likely to be blown off course by a domestic political change. But, I mean, on the terms of having a foreign policy strategy, oddly, I think if you're consumed by domestic politics, in some ways that suits the foreign policy professionals because they just get on with it, you know, and that if nobody's paying any attention, that actually helps with continuity You can set policy, and it's when foreign policy becomes a subject of domestic controversy that they lose control, and you can get oscillations in policy. And what's happening in Britain, in a sense, is, well, was membership of the EU even a foreign policy or a domestic policy? It was both. But it was central to our approach to the world that there was a kind of professionals' consensus that it was a good idea and necessary. But the professionals lost control, and that's why we've got turmoil. And the same is sort of happening in the States, where the domestic political upheavals, although they weren't primarily about foreign policy, have also meant that the foreign policy establishment, Obama derisively called the blob, the blob has sort of been shaken a bit. It hasn't totally lost control, but it's very uncertain because of a domestic political change with foreign policy implications. But in a country like Australia, which I follow less closely, but I get the sense that your domestic turmoil isn't really about your relationships with the outside world. And to that extent, I think it will remain possible, should remain possible, to set a strategic course and pursue it, unless it demands enormous resources in terms of spending that then become domestically unsustainable. But if it's just pursuing a coherent set of ideas, if they're not much discussed, that's actually a good sign.
Well, by chance, we're ending on the pretty much the only optimistic note of the whole discussion. And that's good news for the Australian blob, of which I'm a proud member. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll agree it's been a fascinating discussion. I might ordinarily describe it as a tour d'horizon, but I know in post-Brexit days we can't use French terms like that. You'll note that I did so without a single mention of events at the Gabba earlier this year, although I'm glad to get them on the record now.
Early this week,
I should say. Let me also just mention to the audience that there are a number of events at the Institute between now and Christmas that touch on these very issues. We have a panel in a week or two on Xi Jinping. We're hosting Christopher Pyne, the Defence Industry Minister, who will be talking about the defence build-up that we haven't discussed today, but is an important aspect of Australia's response to some of these changes. And finally, we'll have a report from Washington from Australian Ambassador to the United States, Joe Hockey, I think on the 14th of December. So I hope to see many of you there. But in the meantime, we've had really I've really much, very much enjoyed this discussion, Gideon, and I hope everybody can see why Gideon is absolutely in the must-read column every week. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Gideon Rathman. Thank you, Gideon.